On the edges, boy pops up to rap his reply. In both cases, he doesn't rap about her, he raps about himself. Lin uses the conventions of a pop song to help a 21st century audience understand 18th century social distinctions. And he does it with the extreme concision that a theater song demands. A meeting, a courtship, and a wedding flip by in 4 minutes of stage time in a song that still manages to reach back to the opening number when the chorus sings "In New York, you can be a new man," and set up the finale when Eliza introduces herself by singing, "I have never been the type to try and grab the spotlight." If you're a fan of these R&B hip-hop duets, or were within earshot of the radio within the early years of the century, you know that their all-time king is Ja Rule. Jennifer Lopez and Ashanti had huge hits thanks to his one-in-a-million voice, a bear roaring at the bottom of a well, approximately. One day, near the end of a very long Hamilton rehearsal, when everyone had gotten a little punchy, Lin delivered the last two lines of his helpless rap in a Ja Rule growl. Anything to keep morale up on a long day, you might think. But a few weeks later, when Lin and his Eliza, played by Philippa Sue, had begun to perform the song in actual shows for actual audiences, the distinctively gravelly growl was still there. Was it a tribute to the king of the hip-hop R&B hybrid? No, Lin said. I do it because it makes Pippa laugh. And he was right. When Alexander rumbled through his last couple of lines, Eliza did let out a pretty peal of laughter as he whirled her into their wedding. Chapter 9. On the Perfect Union of Actor and Role, with allusion to Renee Elise Goldsberry. Casting offices can be bad for morale. Actors contort themselves to become something they're not. Writers and directors pretend it's working. During a casting session for Hamilton, though, one audition left Lin, Tommy, and Oscar Eustace, the artistic director for the Public Theater, looking genuinely stunned, as if lightning had flashed through the room. "She's so fast," said Lin, eyes wide. Tommy agreed. "It's from doing all that Shakespeare," Oscar explained. She was Renee Elise Goldsberry, who had just auditioned for the role of Hamilton's sister-in-law and possible love interest, the headstrong and quick-thinking Angelica Schuyler. Renee had indeed performed Shakespearean roles as part of the Public Theater's Shakespeare in the Park seasons. She had also appeared on Broadway 4 times, sung in a top 40 band, and done some TV. It sounds like the kind of cross-training that might prepare somebody for a role in this intensely demanding show. Still, she came very close to not auditioning for it at all, twice. The first near miss was because Renee and her husband had just adopted a baby girl from Ethiopia. Any job that she accepted, they believed, had to be something that felt as monumental as what we were building in our family. Lynn's joking, but actually pretty accurate description of Angelica in the casting notice, that she was a combination of Nicki Minaj and Desiree Armfelt, left Renee cold. Neither the raucous female rapper nor the heroine of A Little Night Music were her type. She decided to stick to her self-imposed maternity leave and stay in Harlem with her son and baby girl. But the casting agents at Telsey & Company persisted. They sent her the demo recording of Angelica's big first act song. One listened to satisfied, convinced Renee that Hamilton might indeed be monumental. So monumental, in fact, that it led to another almost miss. Satisfied was the fastest and most brilliant theater song that she had ever heard. It retraces the ground covered in Helpless, but from Angelica's perspective. As staged by Tommy and choreographer Andy Blankenbuehler, time itself seems to wind backwards, giving the show another chance to suggest that history looks very different depending on who's telling it. She was dazzled by the song's intricacies, but was supposed to perform it for Lin and Tommy the very next day. I just remember thinking, oh no, this is the Motherlode, and it's tomorrow. I can't learn it in a day. In a night, actually. She showed up without any real hope of landing the part, but thought that she might convince Lynn and Tommy to take her money and let her invest in the show. If Renee had stuck around after her audition, if she had seen the expression on Lynn's face after she left the room, she would have known how right for the role she was, and not because of how she had crammed the night before. Renee was the first one who came in and made us say, "Oh, she thinks exactly that fast," he recalls. Her whirring brain made Angelica come alive in a new way. It was the first delivery of Satisfied that didn't make me think for a second about the delivery that was happening. This was, he thought, the key to the song. He hadn't written a rapid-fire rap so that the actor could show off, as in a Gilbert and Sullivan patter song. Her velocity expresses her brilliance and her distress. She's demonstrating that Angelica read Hamilton the moment she saw him, but it didn't stop her from falling in love with him and didn't stop her from calculating in a moment to yield to her sister's love for him. Renee acknowledges that she does indeed think pretty fast, too fast to have good handwriting. But the snug fit between singer and song is also due to the way Lynn wrote it. "The way I memorize is, I memorize a thought process," she says. It's one reason why Oscar thought of her Shakespeare roles. His plays stick with us because his language, in fact any verse, if it's written sharply enough, gives form to our formless thoughts. It's Hamlet debating suicide, to be or not to be, that is the question. And it's Scarface having nightmares. "At night I can't sleep. I toss and turn. Candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned." And it's Angelica Schuyler choosing her sister's happiness over her own. "If a song is written well, you know what you have to say," says Renee. Even in this instance, this woman is talking very fast and making decisions in an instant, but she is extremely analytical. The path is very clear. The path is so intrinsic. She insists that other actresses will have no trouble singing it in future productions. Lynn can't wait to see them try. I want to fast forward to when high schools do Hamilton and the girl playing Angelica Schuyler gets to spit the hardest bars in the show, he tweeted during the run at the Public. Chapter 10. The same subject continued, with allusion to Leslie Odom Jr., plus remarks on the virtues and merits of union. Looking back now, success seems foreordained. It wasn't. No colonists in the history of the world had defeated their mother country on the battlefield to win their independence. Few republics had managed or even attempted to govern an area bigger than a city-state. Somehow, in defiance of all precedent, Washington, Hamilton, and the other founders pulled off both. Their deliriously unlikely success, first as soldiers, then as statesmen, tends to obscure the true lessons of the American Revolution. The past places no absolute limit on the future. Even the unlikeliest changes can occur. But change requires hope. In the case of both those unlikely victories, the hope that the American people could defy all expectation to overcome their differences and set each other free. In the summer of 1788, Alexander Hamilton carried this message to Poughkeepsie, where he pleaded with New York's leaders to trust in the possibilities of union and to vote to ratify the new federal constitution. Yes, he conceded, the 13 newborn states included many different kinds of people, but this did not mean that the government was bound to fail. It took an immigrant to fully understand the new nation and to declare a fundamental hope of the American experiment. Under wise government, these diverse men and women will be constantly assimilating till they embrace each other and assume the same complexion. 225 years later, and about 2 miles up the road from where Hamilton gave that speech, Lynn, Tommy, Lack, and a group of actors assembled to make a crucial step in their own bold experiment. They had been invited to Poughkeepsie to take part in the New York stage and film series of developmental workshops at Vassar College. For a week, they would live together in Vassar dorms, refining Lynn's songs. Beyond providing time to work, the program gave them blessed isolation, a chance to get away from other projects for a while. Tommy exaggerates only slightly when he says that Lynn would wake up in the morning and find him sitting next to the bed, primed with another idea. They had made an important break with precedent before they arrived, the most important, maybe, in the entire development of the show. When they decided that the Hamilton mixtape was going to be a stage musical, not an album, they assumed that they would need spoken dialogue to connect the songs. Song, scene, song, scene has been the standard structure of the modern Broadway musical since Rodgers and Hammerstein perfected the form in the 1940s. Tommy asked a playwright that they both respected enormously to write a libretto, but a single reading with a few scenes of spoken dialogue in January 2013 convinced them that through no fault of the script, everyday speech couldn't sustain the energy of rapt lyrics. That meant that all of the writing duties would fall to Lynn. Every textual problem was now his to solve. Tommy and Jeffrey pep-talked him. He was more skilled now than during In the Heights, they told him. Anyway, nobody else would be able to catch up to him at this point. Fortunately, Lynn was already feeling just super prego, by which he meant, well, it's coming out one way or the other, and nobody else is going to deliver it. At the end of that week in Poughkeepsie, on a hot Saturday afternoon, 150 friends of the production and Broadway professionals crowded into Vassar's powerhouse theater to see what Lynn had birthed. There was no scenery and no blocking. The only accompaniment came from Lack, who played an upright piano, and Scott Wasserman, who supplied loops created on Ableton, the potent musical production software. Still, the audience got to hear something remarkably close to the final version of Act One. When it ended, Lynn treated the crowd to a couple of songs from Act Two. That was as far as he'd written. Sitting in the last row of the audience, more than a little amazed, was Leslie Odom Jr. The young actor was in Poughkeepsie that day to watch his wife, Nicolette Robinson, take part in another reading at New York Stage and Film. When the audience erupted at the end of the encore, Leslie was on his feet too. He sent Lynn a text afterwards to say that he would be the show's biggest cheerleader when it got staged. Lynn and Tommy didn't want him to cheer. They wanted him to act. As they took stock after the week at Vassar, they realized that the actors who had played Burr so far had been too similar to Lynn. What was great about Leslie is that, in every way, he's a contrast to me, says Lynn. He's cool. His blood runs cool. He's elegant. It sounds like I'm reverse describing myself as a feral monster. Anyway, he's my opposite. Or as Lynn said of Leslie around that time, dude makes me look scruffy. Lynn and Tommy had approached Leslie about taking part in an early workshop of Hamilton, but his schedule had prevented him. That fall, they tried again, inviting him to read Burr the next time they gathered some actors to test new material. He said yes, and immediately got to work. A lot of work. How do you let people know what you want? Leslie asks. You let them know through preparation. You show them. By the time the reading came around, he had memorized the role. For a brief workshop with no audience, learning a part as big as Aaron Burr is a preposterous display of dedication. The role seemed to be his. But once again, something that seems inevitable in retrospect almost didn't happen at all. Like most young actors, Leslie had operated on the theory that the road to stage success lay through television. As he puts it, you get the cover of EW, then you come back to Broadway. After 10 years of struggling, a guest role on Smash had finally paved the way for a lead role on a new network drama, State of Affairs. This posed a dilemma. Move to Los Angeles for a shot at TV success, or stay in New York to play Burr? It was a choice, he says, between my Grey's Anatomy and my childhood dream. Going to Los Angeles, he knew, was the smart thing to do, the adult thing to do. I want to buy my mama a house, too. Even if he chose to stay in New York, his fate wasn't entirely up to him. He had already signed a network contract. What was he supposed to do, go to war with NBC? After some sleepless nights, he got on an airplane. He went to Los Angeles and sought out his patrons in the TV business. He explained his situation. They let him go. And nobody else has gotten near the role of Aaron Burr since. So, there is no house in the hills for Leslie just yet. Instead, he spent a lot of 2014 working on Burr songs with Lack. "He gets in the sandbox with you," says Leslie. "He helped me so much." He also hit the books. He lugged a 2-volume biography of Burr, a gift from Oscar, back and forth from his apartment in Brooklyn to rehearsals all over Manhattan. It requires some imagination to think of Leslie straining under a heavy bag. Besides being the best-dressed person in almost every room he enters, he exudes an easy grace that makes it hard to imagine him being weighed down by anything. After a long day and night of rehearsal, Leslie still lights up when he talks about playing Aaron Burr. "Lynn is asking you to bring your complete and total self to the stage. All your joy, all your rage, all your pain, your capacity for fun. Burr," he says, "is arguably the best role for a male actor of color in the musical theater canon. Ever? Ever. You get to show all your colors. Nobody asks us to do that." It's true that there's something new and potent about Burr. We've seen the nemesis as narrator before. Think of Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar. But even in the songs that Leslie first heard at Vassar, there are depths and complexities to Burr that make him the equal of the title character. One song in particular captivated Leslie that day. He didn't catch its name. He only knew that it had to do something with waiting. And whoever got to sing it would be one lucky actor. Now Leslie is the one who gets to sing Wait For It, Burr's musical declaration of his code. When he talks about the song, he sounds like a mountain climber just returned from a treacherous peak, or a bullfighter back from the ring. "You don't have to put anything on Wait For It," he says. "Just sing it with honesty and as much vulnerability as you can. Don't get ahead of it," which is a very Burr-like thing to say. "I love it. God, I love it," he says of the song. "I'll sing it for the rest of my life." And every time he does, it will be a little different from the times that he sang it before. Leslie says that it's vital to sing the song to the audience. "They're my confidants." That means that the song changes as the crowd changes. Its size, its composition, the way it emits a million little signals that a first-rate actor can detect from the stage. In other words, to state the revolutionary lesson one more time, what happened yesterday never guarantees what'll happen tonight. Chapter 11, wherein Mobb Deep is sampled and the immortal Biggie Smalls is revived. "I want to add a sample," Lynn said. He had come to the theater early one morning to listen to Alex Lacamoire's soundcheck with the band. He was a little bleary-eyed and was standing in front of a nearly empty theater wearing his "Rehearsal is the best part" hoodie. "We cleared it," he told Lack. "Let's use it." He propped his laptop on the edge of the stage and played the song that he had cleared, that is, he had gotten permission to quote in the show. "Shook Ones, Part 2" by Mobb Deep, one of the grimy classics of 90s New York hip-hop. He had incorporated one of the song's best-known lyrics in "My Shot." Now he wanted to evoke the distinctive siren effect that opens the track, a sharp rising squeal, a sound of trouble on the way. Lack cocked an ear toward Lynn's laptop, staring into the middle distance. If he had heard the song before, he didn't say so. "That's cool," he said, after listening a few times. He wondered if they should use a snippet from the actual record. Lynn said that he would rather not. Before making Hamilton, he co-wrote a new musical version of the movie Bring It On, which Lack music directed. The experience taught them how tricky it can be to blend pre-recorded samples and live instruments in the theater. They ended up using Ableton to supply some of the sounds in Hamilton: record scratches, the rewind sound effect in Satisfied, some of the drum loops, etc. But wherever possible, they tried to generate every sound from within the 10-person band. Lynn thought there might be a way to evoke the Mobb Deep squeal that way. Steampunk sampling, he calls it. Alex explored up and down his keyboard, trying to find the note. Let's do it with a violin, Lynn suggested, with crazy vibrato. Alex described to the 4-person string section what he was looking for. A violinist began to scrape away, looking for the right tone. It's subtle, said Lynn, but Mobb Deep fans will love it. Alex decided he was ready to try it. The band tore into My Shot with Lynn rapping along. When he got to the Mobb Deep line, I'm only 19, but my mind is older, one of the violins unleashed a shrill, dissonant tone that slid higher as it went. The hip-hop fans in the room laughed in recognition. Lynn beamed and threw a couple of triumphant middle fingers in the air. Hamilton is laced with these shout-outs to the traditions that birthed it. Both hip-hop, DMX, Grandmaster Flash, and Furious Five, and musical theater, South Pacific, the last 5 years. These serve, in part, as invitations, a signal to people from diverse backgrounds that the show is meant for them. When Lynn rapped in the opening number of In the Heights that it's gotten too darn hot, like my man Cole Porter said, he was creating a crossroads for himself, where much of his subsequent work has appeared, Hamilton very much included. In this show, though, the shout-outs have a subtle second meaning. They're another way of saying that American history can be told and retold, claimed and reclaimed, even by people who don't look like George Washington and Betsy Ross. Alexander Hamilton, who spent his life trying to live down his lowly origins, knew better than the other founding fathers that even something as unprecedented and revolutionary as the United States would carry traces of many tangled traditions. The same way that My Shot carries the DNA of Shook Ones, which in turn sampled Quincy Jones and Herbie Hancock, who had their own constellations of riffs, quotes, inspirations. The predecessor who gets sampled the most in Hamilton is the notorious B.I.G., a.k.a. Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. the King of New York, the greatest rapper of all time. Lynn's annotations reveal the many subtle ways that Biggie influenced the show. In one song, Ten Dual Commandments, the influence couldn't be more direct or profound. Lynn and Tommy wanted to explain the rules of the code duello in the first act. That way, when the show rose to its second act climax, the Hamilton-Burr confrontation, they could skip the mechanics of dueling and focus on the question that has tortured historians for 2 centuries. What happened on that cliff in Weehawken? What were Hamilton and Burr doing up there? Biggie's song, Ten Crack Commandments, gave Lynn the template he needed. The rules of dueling slip neatly into spots originally occupied by the rules of selling crack. The enormous shadow of Biggie himself proved useful too, as his story helps to collapse the distance between the revolutionary era and our own time. How, you think, could somebody with the brilliance and the survival instincts of Alexander Hamilton find himself looking down the barrel of a gun, giving his friend-turned-nemesis a chance to put a .54-caliber bullet in his spine? It's not so hard to imagine. Christopher Wallace, a.k.a. the notorious B.I.G., etc., etc., was a lyrical genius, a master storyteller, an inspiration to millions, and nobody's fool. He was shot and killed at 24. That murder still hasn't been solved. Chapter 12 of Oscar Eustace, his politics, his eventful career, his thoughts on verse drama, and his stewardship of the public theater, with a word about the Far Side. 3 days after Lynn and Tommy returned from their week in Poughkeepsie, on July 30th, 2013, they met producer Jeffrey Seller at Café Luxembourg on Manhattan's Upper West Side to eat lunch and talk strategy. What should the Hamilton mixtape's next move be? Or, more to the point, when and where? Lynn and Tommy said that they were ready to plunge ahead. The week at Vassar had been fruitful, the audience effusive. They wanted to go into rehearsal on a full production before the end of 2014. That seemed aggressive to Jeffrey. Theaters often get booked years in advance. Also, he pointed out, they still didn't have a second act. Don't worry, Lynn said. I'm going to your house in September, meaning Jeffrey's home in the Hamptons, where he would churn out the remaining songs. So much for the question of when. But where would the production be? Everyone agreed that New York was the best city in which to develop a hip-hop musical about a founding father. But there are dozens of theaters in the city. Which one offered the best fit? A week later, they arranged to visit three off-Broadway theaters that seemed like the most promising places to prepare the show for a Broadway run. The college tour, as they called it, led to a unanimous favorite. I want to go to the public, said Jeffrey. We're going to do a chorus line. It's a new musical. Nobody knows anything about it. Nobody cares about it. Yet. The Public Theater was indeed the birthplace of a chorus line, as well as the process that made Michael Bennett's unheralded, unprecedented musical possible, a series of workshops that gave the creative team a chance to refine their show, away from the glare and commercial pressure of Broadway. A chorus line marks the pinnacle of the Public's half-century tradition of adventurous, socially conscious musicals, including Hair, Bring Into Noise, Bring Into Funk, Caroline or Change, and Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. The inheritor of that tradition is the Public's artistic director, Oscar Eustace. If he were king of the forest, a phrase Oscar uses a lot, life would be what Gonzalo dreams of in The Tempest. There would be no riches or poverty. All things in common nature should produce without sweat or endeavor. Like Lynn, he had a father involved in Democratic politics. Unlike Lynn, he had a mother and stepfather in the leadership of the Communist Party of America. To bide his time until the proletariat rises, Oscar develops and produces plays, particularly scripts by new voices. The last theatrical work to do what Hamilton has done, leap off the arts pages and become central to the country's cultural conversation, was one that Oscar commissioned and developed 30 years earlier, Angels in America. His work with Tony Kushner is a big reason why he is regarded, by people who keep track of such things, as the greatest dramaturge alive. Oscar already knew Lynn, Tommy, and Jeffrey when they arrived for their tour. The Public had hosted a series of developmental concerts for Sting's musical, The Last Ship, which Jeffrey had produced. And Oscar was 2 years into an artistic love affair with Lynn. At first, his feelings about the young composer weren't exactly cheerful. In the Heights had won its 4 Tony Awards at the expense of Passing Strange, which had premiered at the Public. But Oscar liked Lynn as soon as they met, and his reaction to the half-dozen demo recordings that Lynn sent afterwards was immediate and fierce. Lynn seemed a little overwhelmed by this enthusiasm. Oscar is a big man with a big heart, and at that early stage, hardly anybody had heard Lynn's Hamilton songs, let alone raved about them. I should do these meetings more often, Lynn said after one of those effusions. They make me feel like a better writer. Choosing the Public gave Lynn and Tommy what they wanted. Oscar and Patrick Willingham, the Public's executive director, scheduled the show for the 2014-15 season, exactly the time frame that they had desired. It gave Lynn a year to finish writing the show, and Tommy a year to figure out how to stage it. The Public put a couple of workshops on the calendar, intermediate deadlines that Lynn and Tommy could work toward. Lynn grabbed his dog and his notebooks and headed for the Hamptons, where Jeffrey's upright piano awaited. Jeffrey got what he wanted, too. Later, when somebody asked him about his marketing campaign for Hamilton, he said that going to the Public was the marketing campaign. He wanted to brand the show by associating it with what he called the quintessential New York downtown theater laboratory. And Oscar got what he wanted in double measure. From his earliest encounters with the show, listening to Lynn's demos, attending the American Songbook concert, making the trek to Vassar, he saw that Hamilton could do more than extend the tradition of great public musicals. Its use of hip-hop would allow it to build on the tradition of Shakespeare in the Park. He calls the show a perfect example of verse drama. Lin does exactly what Shakespeare does, he says. He takes the language of the people and heightens it by making it verse. It both ennobles the language and the people saying the language. That's precisely what Shakespeare did in all of his work, particularly in his history plays. He tells the foundational myths of his country. By doing that, he makes the country the possession of everybody. You can see what he means in Meet Me Inside, Washington's angry confrontation with the hot-headed Hamilton. Music accompanies the dialogue, but the language has a rhythm that strays far from the beat. The exchange shows why, until about 200 years ago, virtually every playwright in the Western tradition wrote in verse. It has lift, concision, drive. It demands and rewards your attention. Here is another Hamilton paradox. Half a century later, after verse storytelling, the technique that worked so well in Medea, Tartuffe, and Othello was declared dead on the American stage, it has been revived by somebody who learned it not from a textbook or in drama school, but from listening endlessly to Friend or Foe, Everything is Fair, and the first album by The Far Side. Chapter 13. On Philippa Sue and the Trouble with Goodness. Three times, Hollywood optioned Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton. Three times, it came to naught. "I just don't get it," Ron would tell his agent in the years that followed the book's publication in 2004. "This story has all the ingredients you could possibly want. Sex, violence, genius." When Lin optioned his book, Ron was relieved that the founding father who had the most dramatic and least appreciated life story would finally get his due, even though a rap musical was the last way that Ron had anticipated Hamilton getting it. Still, he knew that plenty of traps awaited anybody who wanted to adapt this story. For starters, what do you do about Eliza? Petite and vivacious, Eliza Schuyler Hamilton won the affection of everyone she met. "She was a most earnest, energetic, and intelligent woman," recalled one of her sons. The letters that Hamilton exchanged with his Betsy don't have the lightning flash quality of his letters to and from the witty Angelica, but they glow all the same. Eliza changed his life, and might have saved it. "I was once determined to let my existence and American liberty end together," he wrote to her during their engagement. "My Betsy has given me a motive to outlive my pride." Eliza's warmth and vibrancy made her a remarkable woman, but they also made her a challenging character. "It's difficult to make pure goodness compelling," Ron says. Tommy found a solution before he even realized they had a problem. In late 2012, he saw Dave Malloy's stage adaptation of War and Peace, an electro-pop musical titled Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. When the lights came up at intermission, he turned to the casting agent sitting nearby and said, "What are you waiting for?" He was talking about Philippa Sue, the recent Juilliard grad who was making her off-Broadway debut. "That girl who played Natasha, she's a star," he told Lin the next day. "There's just something there." A year later, Pippa was leaving breakfast at a diner in Washington Heights when her phone rang. The diner had a Heights poster on the wall, a tribute to Lin. "He's basically the mayor up here," she says. Tommy was calling to invite her to read Eliza in a workshop of the still unfinished Act Two. She said yes and came to read the role in December 2013 at the first workshop that Jeffrey produced in conjunction with the public. "Then she was it," says Lin. And she was it from then on. Lin liked Pippa for the role because audiences instantly and instinctively warmed to her, just as Eliza's contemporaries had done. "Pippa has this sort of elegance and this lit from within quality," he says. "She's so poised and in such control of what she can do, which is kind of amazing for an actor or actress of her age. I certainly wasn't in control of whatever the hell I had at that age." Though she was young, only a year out of college, she had been performing since her early childhood in Chicago. Her father, who was a doctor, and her mother, who was active in the city's theaters, supported her desire to perform, whether it was acting, singing, or dancing. She even did some modeling. Her half-Chinese heritage gave her a distinctive beauty. Pippa's grandparents, her father's mother and father, had immigrated to this country before they were married. She treasures a photo of her grandfather on the boat that carried him across the Pacific in 1949. Eliza's devotion was constant, but in the course of her life, and therefore in a single performance of Hamilton, virtually everything else about her changes, and fast. The swoony young girl who sings Helpless reappears a few minutes later as a pregnant young wife, describing what kind of life she wants with her husband, and that would be enough. As Pippa began to navigate these changes, she asked to meet with Ron Chernow. Their conversation gave her a new understanding of Eliza, as she had hoped it would, but not in the way she expected. The impression that lasted on me more than the actual facts was how wonderful he thought Eliza was, and how that matched how he felt about his own wife. Ron told Pippa that during the 6 years he had spent on the book, Valerie Chernow had developed a powerful identification with Hamilton's wife. She used to say, "Eliza is like me. She's good, she's true, she's loyal, she's not ambitious." There was a purity and a goodness about the character, and that was like Valerie, he says. In 2006, after 27 years of marriage, Valerie passed away. For her gravestone, Ron chose a line from the letter that Hamilton wrote Eliza on the night before the duel, "Best of wives and best of women." For all his early worries about the role, Ron knew, as soon as he saw Pippa, that the show had found its Eliza. Some friends pointed out that Pippa even looks a little like Valerie. Her ballad, "That Would Be Enough," in particular, moves him deeply. "Just heartbreakingly beautiful," he says. Chapter 14. On Paul Tazewell and the Fashion of Revolution. "This is a day of firsts," said Tommy. It was May 9th, 2014, and he was looking up at the 150 people who packed the top floor theater at the 52nd Street Project, a program that specializes in plays created for and by kids, and sometimes offers space to shows like Hamilton. They had come for what he called the first time we will ever have done the first and second act back to back. "Going for a laugh," he said, "you are the first audience in the history of the world to have seen that." The show's title was another first that day. Jeffrey had persuaded Lynn to drop Mixtape a few months earlier. He joked that it might be the most important contribution he made to the show. "Hamilton sounds like a blockbuster," he says. "At least it does now." Tommy warned the audience that Lynn had been adding and changing things until the night before. "You'll be hearing things that not even he has heard out loud," he said. Lynn can't help himself. "Finishing a tune at 10:30 for actors who are learning it at 11, he had tweeted during a workshop the previous fall. "Horrible, horrible. When will I stop doing my homework on the bus? I'm 33. The company had spent 5 weeks experimenting with different ways to move people and furniture around the stage. 5 weeks was an unusually long time, but not nearly long enough to figure out how to stage this show. Tommy had been feeling stressed about how to speed up the process when Lack reminded him that nobody was forcing them to do anything. Tommy realized he was right. They decided to stage Act One and fall back to music stands for Act Two. But the biggest first of that workshop and its real revelation was what the cast wore. Looking back now, the costume choices of Hamilton seem obvious. Nobody thought so in May 2014, not even the man who made them. In his 20 years on Broadway, Paul Tazewell had designed costumes for shows set in the distant past: The Color Purple, Dr. Zhivago, and our own time, Magic Bird, In the Heights. When he heard Lynn's demos, he knew that Hamilton would need to combine both sensibilities. But as with Korn's scenic design, the question was, how? The challenge was figuring out where those two eras meet and what percentage of this world is hip-hop and what percentage is 18th century, he says. He looked at a lot of street fashion from our time and John Trumbull's paintings from Alexander Hamilton's time. He studied the work of fashion designers who had tried to mash up the two eras, Jean-Paul Gaultier, Alexander McQueen, John Galliano. Everyone has riffed on the 18th century at one time or another, he says. In spite of his experience, his well-stocked toolkit, and the formidable pile of research, Paul couldn't locate the right point of intersection between past and present. Luckily, he and Tommy had collaborated on five productions before this, developing enough mutual trust to remain untroubled by the fact that they weren't sure what to do. We thought the only way to figure this out is to try it, says Paul. Since they knew what the cast looked like in contemporary clothes, because that's what the actors wore to rehearsal every day, Paul used the workshop to experiment with an intensely authentic design. Period from the neck down, modern from the neck up, became the rule. I didn't want Chris to be in a powdered wig as Washington, Paul says. I wanted to see him for who he was. This choice by itself didn't constitute a first. Joe Papp started putting black and Latino actors in period costumes for his free Shakespeare productions more than half a century ago. More recently, visual artists such as Kehinde Wiley, some of whose work Paul consulted during his research, have painted contemporary black men in the trappings of old master portraits. Still, the sight of the cast in Paul's costumes made the show seem doubly, triply audacious. The biggest jolt came toward the end of Act One, when the actors came on stage wearing blue coats with red trim and brass buttons. Unmistakably, the uniforms of George Washington's Continental Army. That day, for the first time, 150 audience members had the mind-altering experience of watching black and Latino actors, young men and women from communities that have seen their freedom infringed for hundreds of years, win freedom for us all. People wept at intermission. They screamed at the finale. In the cramped lobby afterwards, you could hear a potent clatter of emotions, euphoria, disbelief, desperation. This last from people who wanted to invest in the show. There were four presentations between Thursday and Saturday, which meant that 600 people fanned out that weekend to tell their friends what they had seen. By Monday, Hamilton had become the most talked about, not quite show in New York. For Tommy, the experiment of putting actors in period costumes had been a complete success. One choice that had seemed like a concession to the spare nature of workshops, putting all the actors in parchment-toned clothes and adding colors only when they distinguished themselves as specific characters, carried all the way to Broadway. Paul was delighted by the outcome, too. He had received 5 Tony Award nominations in his career, but still wanted badly to get this one right. This piece is so humbling, he says, tears rising in his eyes. I really didn't want to fuck it up and get in the way of it. There are certain places where it resonates, where I remember, oh yeah, I'm a part of this. Not this production, I know what I bring to the production, but being an American, I am part of it. As opposed to being, he searched for the right word, an afterthought. When the Battle of Yorktown sequence ended that day, the largely black and Latino cast, singing a song written by a Puerto Rican composer, wearing costumes selected by an African-American designer, climbed on the top of boxes and chairs to celebrate having done the impossible. Andy Blankenbuehler would spend the next 16 months trying to recapture how exhilarating that moment felt. It took him until a week before opening night on Broadway to feel that he had succeeded. Chapter 15. by which it will appear that good history makes good drama, and in which Sebastian Miranda makes his debut. Yorktown could have been a rousing finale for Act One, a way to send the audience to the lobby feeling precisely what they wanted to feel about the country's birth. After all, didn't it happen just as the song suggests? The unerring Washington led us to freedom with military victory and crisp dances, and then everybody lived happily ever after? That sunny view is radically incomplete, as the founders themselves tried to tell us. John Adams, who lived long enough to see the legend taking root, begged us to remember that the country's birth was painful, contentious, and not remotely finished when the British went home. It was patched and piebald policy then, as it is now, ever was and ever will be, world without end. The show spends much of Act Two making Adams look like a fat fool. But in refusing to treat the victory at Yorktown as the tidy end of the nation's birth, it takes his side. And the surprise is that good history also makes for good drama. Instead of letting the audience spend intermission basking in a false view of the founder's infallibility, Lynn and Tommy decided to extend Act One with a pair of songs that are explicit about the mistakes that they are going to make, the patched and piebald things about to go down. There was only one song that could follow Yorktown, or at least one character. After Yorktown, King George is the only person you're willing to have start singing, says Oscar. Anybody else, and here he mimed looking at his watch. Lynn could have made What Comes Next a simple comic turn, a lament by a petulant sore loser. Actually, the king is a petulant sore loser, but he asked the leaders of the new nation an unexpectedly sobering question. Do you know how hard it is to lead? And then he offers a stark bit of wisdom. It's much harder when it's all your call. Those lines set up the fights that will animate the rest of the show, something Yorktown couldn't do. You have to end an act with a dramatic question, says Tommy. Ending a war is not a question. What you do with that is the question. Lynn paired the king's warning of political dangers with an admission of personal flaws. His research turned up a coincidence that intrigued him. Alexander Hamilton became a parent at the same time he was trying to birth a new nation. And, double coincidence, so did Aaron Burr. Philip Hamilton was born in January 1782, Theodosia Burr in June 1783. Lynn wrote Dear Theodosia, a duet for the new fathers that is joyous but remarkably uncertain. If we lay a strong enough foundation, we'll pass it on to you, they sing. The only thing that's sure is how much they're going to screw it up. I'll make a million mistakes, sings Burr. Chernow was impressed by this refusal to deify the founders, one reason he calls the show American History for Grown-Ups. Of course, most people are too busy fumbling for Kleenex during Dear Theodosia to admire the song's historiographical rigor. This is particularly true of the people who welcomed new children during the show's development. Like Jeffrey Seller and Sander Jacobs, Jill Furman is an above-the-title producer of Hamilton. She went to Lynn's American Songbook concert in 2012 and came away just as exhilarated as she had been on the night she went to the little theater in the basement of the drama bookshop and discovered a New Yorkerican rapper actor composer playwright who was writing a show about Washington Heights. Jill had a son just before the public run began, and even now she turns into what she calls a total basket case when she hears the song. Lynn can't even make eye contact with her until it ends. So how did he write a song so evocative? One that is both precise and universal, one that made us see our baby's faces. New Fatherhood inspires young composer to write beautiful duet is a simple, lovely story, but it's just as false as the simple, lovely view of the nation's founding. I wrote Dear Theodosia the week I adopted our dog, Lynn says, although even this isn't the full story, as he explains in his annotations to the song. Fatherhood didn't shape the way Lynn wrote Dear Theodosia, but it has changed the way he performs it. On November 10th, 2014, Lynn's wife, Vanessa, gave birth to their first son, Sebastian. I play it differently because I have a real kid in my head now. I have access to a new depth of feeling of this is a life I'm responsible for. The main purpose of my life is this kid's life. Everything else is secondary, he says. It's not an abstract, my child. Now, it's my child. Hamilton's love for Philip was just as deep as Lynn's for his son. But as Dear Theodosia anticipates, he sometimes did a lousy job of putting it into effect. A question that recurred in script meetings over the years was, is the flawed, historically accurate Hamilton too unsympathetic? Were his failures as a husband, a leader, and father alienating the audience? That has not been the experience of Javier Munoz. As Lynn's alternate, he needs to embody Hamilton's complexities as fully as the man who dramatized them. But since he only performs the role once a week, he spends most of his working hours getting to observe how an audience responds to them. Nobody associated with Hamilton combines a view from the center and a view from the periphery more completely than he does. Hamilton's failures don't strike Javier as obstacles. On the contrary, they are how he finds his way into the role. Most characters in musicals make one or two mistakes, but otherwise they're perfect. I get bored with characters like those. He knows what he's talking about. Born and raised in Brooklyn, he spent years stringing together gigs in regional theater, finally getting a shot at Broadway as an ensemble member of In the Heights. That's the life I live. I live an openly flawed life, he says, and he thinks these flaws are precisely why Hamilton's story exerts such a potent hold on people. They allow the audience to say, I'm okay the way I am, flawed and human. It pulls them in closer. Playing Hamilton presents all sorts of challenges. Serving as the other Hamilton amplifies those challenges and adds some fresh ones. Since the primary Hamilton was also the show's writer and a fearless improviser, thanks to Freestyle Love Supreme, Javier had to track Lynn's every move throughout rehearsals. There was no telling when he might try something and like it enough to keep it. If he has done something a certain way two times, that's when I would ask him, is that a change, says Javier? Still, Hamilton, as Lynn calls him, is palpably grateful for the chance to play the role. They've given me their baby to take care of and watch, he says. It feels that precious. When he comes to the theater six times a week to perform the role in the wings, every line, every song, without going on stage, it's not out of an abstract sense of duty. This is live theater, he explains. It's always changing. The only way to stay in sync with his castmates as they continually discover new things and deepen their relationships is to change with them. It's not a metaphor to call a play like Hamilton a living, changing thing. It has the same surprising life as a baby or a new nation. Chapter 16. On Nonstop, both the song and The Way of Life, as manifest by Andy Blankenbuehler and the Public Theater's Props Department. 6 years after Lynn read Ron Chernow's book, 5 years after he rapped at the White House, the Hamilton team had only 8 working days left to get the show ready for its first audience. They knew that it wasn't enough time. Hamilton was one of the most complex productions ever staged in the Newman Theater, the public's 290-seat proscenium space. Those 8 days in January 2015 were spent during technical rehearsals, tech for short, in which the actors worked through the show on stage a few seconds at a time, so every sound level, lighting cue, and movement choice could be tested and tweaked. There was a lot to test and tweak. 1,300 cues, said James Latus, the production stage manager for the downtown run, leafing through his heavily marked up script, sounding like a man paddling across the Atlantic. Tech is grueling under the best circumstances, and these were not the best of circumstances. 12-hour days, heavy woolen costumes, an overhead grid bristling with hot lights. In the dark audience, James and the designer sat at folding tables loaded with laptops, consoles, and assorted abstruse gear. It looked like mission control if NASA's business were launching rockets full of rapping multiracial actors in colonial garb into space. For the most part, Lynn behaved like any other member of the cast, goofing around, singing cartoon-themed songs, trying to keep himself and everybody else sane. Lack was out of sight. He and the band were offstage left in a loft 10 feet off the ground, adjusting the musicians' charts. Tommy kept making circuits around the tables in the audience, checking in with the designers, giving feedback. He didn't stray from what he wears almost every day, an untucked button-down shirt and jeans. He said that he saves his decision-making energy for the choices that count. Those choices came at him all day long. 1,300 cues. 8 days became 7, and then 6. Daily, hourly, the show's ambitions were put to the test. All of the ideas that had sounded so good in production meetings or had looked so promising in the rehearsal room had to survive the proving ground of the actual stage. Everything had to add up to form a complete, coherent reality. For Tommy, the brushwork mattered as much as the broad strokes. It was really important in a world where we didn't have roofs or walls that the props and clothing were going to root us in time, especially because of the contemporary language. Much of the finest brushwork fell to Jay Duckworth, the prop master of the public, and his colleagues, Sarah Swanberg and Sidney Schatz. They found or built objects in every size and description that actors carried on David Corn's set. They carried verisimilitude as far as it could go, which turns out to be very, very far. During the Yorktown sequence, when Washington consults Comte de Rochambeau's map, Chris Jackson looks at Rochambeau's actual map, reproduced on parchment paper treated with Mod Podge so it resembles sheepskin. Newspapers figure in several places during the show, and each one includes stories that ran in actual New York newspapers, drawn from the exact month the scene takes place. Jay and Sarah exempted only one kind of prop from this fastidious approach. Pamphlets that might end up falling into the audience were filled with nonsense strings of Latin words so as not to distract audience members from watching the show. The candles on stage are real wax, because nothing else looks like wax. The seals on the letters by Washington and Hamilton are real wax as well. Each man gets his own personalized seal. Asking Jay why even the tiniest, least visible props deserve this kind of attention is like asking a hawk why he flaps his wings so much. 5 seconds pass before he replies, because it has to be. He thinks it's unfair to ask actors to go on stage and expose themselves with anything less than what he calls ultimate support. Tommy agrees, regarding a personalized wax seal as just as vital to the show's reality as a piece of scenery. The only people who see it are the actors, but the actors see it. Here again, the creators of Hamilton are channeling their subject. The inexhaustible Hamilton didn't just organize an army for the new United States and propose a system of ranks and units for commanding it. He also designed its uniforms, fussing over details as minuscule as the color of George Washington's buttons and his plume, yellow and white, respectively. 6 days became 5 and then 4. Because Hamilton was completely sung through, it was almost completely danced through. So no matter what else was happening during tech, Andy Blankenbuehler was on his feet, rushing on stage to give a note, rushing back to see how it was playing. Woe to anybody who happened to be in his way. Andy wasn't rude or angry. He smiled a lot, all things considered, but he simply didn't notice any human form between him and the dancers executing his combinations. The stress on him was enormous. He didn't find it unusual. I'm kind of always at the same state. a state of general exhaustion, because my brain never stops. My brain runs at a very fast pace. Pretty much always, I think. I work out constantly. I never sit around. Even at home, I'm doing my own yard work. I go to the gym every day. I'm warming up all the time. I'm working all the time. I don't sleep enough. Lynn admired his work ethic and learned from it. On Andy's 45th birthday in 2015, he tweeted a little tribute to his choreographer. Happy birthday to Andy Blankenbuehler. You guys know that when I'm playing Hamilton, I'm really just playing him, right? Hashtag relentless genius. In Nonstop, Lynn very explicitly asks, what makes a genius relentless?